Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, 9th Canto, Chapter 20, Text 2. There's actually quite a few verses that don't have purports or have a very, very short purport. So I'm going to go through till text, actually 15, and which has a substantial purport. And that's the one we'll chant together, and I'll just chant all the others prior to that by myself, okay? Okay. Janame jayo hi abhut puro prachin vamstat sutastata pravirota manushurvai tasmach charu pado bhavat. Translation. King Janamejaya was born of this dynasty of Puru. Janamejaya's son was Prachinvan, and his son was Pravira. Thereafter, Pravira's son was Manushu. And from Manushu came the son named Charupada. Text 3. Tashyasajar abhut putras tasmad bahugavastata samyatis tasya hamyati rodras vastatsuta smrita. The son of Charupada was Suju, and the son of Suju was Bahugava. Bahugava's son was Samyati. From Samyati came a son named Ahamyati, and from whom Rodrasva was born. Uteyus tasya kakseyu standileyu kriteyu ka jaleyu sanateyuscha dharma satya vrateyava daishate prasrasa putra vaneyus chavama smrita britachyam indriyaniva mukyasya jagaratmana. Translation. Rodrasva had 10 sons named Ruteyu, Kaksheyu, Standileyu, Krityuka, Jaleyu, Sanateyu, Dharmeyu, Satyeyu, Vrateyu, and Vaneyu. Of these 10 sons, Vaneyu was the youngest. As the 10 senses, which are products of the universal life, act under the control of life, these 10 sons of Rodrasva acted under Rodrasva's full control. All of them were born of the apsara named Gritachi. Ruteyu rantinavo butrayas tasyatmajo nirpa sumatir druvo pratrata kanvo pratiratatmaja. Ruteyu had a son named Rantinava, who had 3 sons named Sumati, Dhruva, and Apratirata. Apratirata had only 1 son, whose name was Kanva. Tasya medhatitis tasmat plaskanadya dvijataya putrabhut sumate rebhir dusmantas tatsuta mata. Translation. The son of Kanva was Medhatiti, whose sons, all Brahmins, were headed by Praskana. The son of Rantinava, named Sumati, had a son named Rebbe. Maharaj Dushmanta is well known as the son of Rebbe. Dushmanto mrigayam yata kanvashrama padam gata tatrasinam svapadhaya mandayantim ramam iva. Vilokya saja mumehu devamayam ivastriyam babase tam vararoham bhattai katipayar vrita. Translation. Okay, now we get some story. Once when King Dusmanta went to the forest to hunt and was very fatigued, he approached the residence of Kanva Muni. There was a most beautiful woman who looked exactly like the goddess of fortune and who sat there illuminating the entire ashram by her effulgence. The king was naturally attracted by her beauty, and therefore he approached her, accompanied by some of his soldiers, and spoke to her. Tadarshana pramudita sanivritta parishrama prapricha kama santapta prahasan slakshnayagira. Seeing the beautiful woman, the king was very much enlivened, and the fatigue of his hunting excursion was relieved. He was, of course, very much attracted because of lusty desires, and thus he inquired from her as follows, in a joking mood. Katvam kamala patrakshi kasyasi ridayangame kim svich chikirshitam tatra bhavatya nirjane vane. Oh, beautiful lotus-eyed woman, who are you? Whose daughter are you? What purpose do you have in this solitary forest? Why are you staying here? Vyaktam rajanya tanayam vedmai aham tvam samudyame nahi cheta poravanam adharme ramate kvachit. Oh, most beautiful one, it appears to my mind that you must be the daughter of a kshatriya. Because I belong to the Puru dynasty, my mind never endeavors to enjoy anything irreligiously. Purport. Maharaj Dushmanta indirectly expressed his desire to marry Shakuntala, for she appeared to his mind to be the daughter of some Kshatriya king. Sri Shakuntala Uvacha Vishvamitrama Javaiham Tyaktva Menakaya Vane Vidaitad Bhagavan Kanvo Vira Kim Karavamate. Shakuntala said, I am the daughter of Vishvamitra. My mother, Menaka, left me in the forest, O hero. O hero, this most powerful saint, Kanva Muni, knows all about this. Now let me know how I may serve you. Purport. Shakuntala informed Maharaj Dushmanta that although she never saw or knew her father or mother, Kanva Muni knew everything about her. And she had heard from him that she was the daughter of Vishvamitra and that her mother was Menaka, who had left her in the forest. Text 14. Asyatam hi aravindaksha griyatam arhanam chana bujatam shantinir nivara usyatam yari rochate. O king, with eyes like the petals of a lotus, kindly come sit down and accept whatever reception we can offer. We have a supply of naivara rice that you may kindly take. And if you so desire, stay here without hesitation. Okay, so now 15, and we can chant this one together. Sri Dushmanta Uvacha Upapanamidam Sabru Upapanamidam Subru Jataya Kushikanvaye Jataya Kushikanvaye Swayam hi Vrinute Ragyam Swayam hi Vrinute Rajnam Kanyaka Sadrisam Varam Kanyaka Sadrisam Varam Sri Dushmanta Uvacha Upapanamidam Subru Jataya Kushikanvaye Swayam hi Vrinute Rajnam Kanyaka Sadrisam Varam.
Others?
Maharajis, Vaishnavis. Shri Dushmanta Vacha. King Dushmanta replied, Upapanam, just befitting your position. Idam, this. Subru, O Shakuntala, with beautiful eyebrows. Jataya, because of your birth. Kusika, Anbaye, in the family of Vishvamitra. Swayam, personally, he, indeed, Vrinute, select, Rajnam, of a royal family, Kanyaka, daughters, Sadrasam, on an equal level, Varam, husbands. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. King Dushmanta replied, O Shakuntala, with beautiful eyebrows, you have taken your birth in the family of the great saint Vishvamitra, and your reception is quite worthy of your family. Aside from this, the daughters of a king generally select their own husbands. Purport. In her reception of Maharaj Dushmanta, Shakuntala clearly said, Your Majesty may stay here, and you may accept whatever reception I can offer. Thus she indicated that she wanted Maharaj Dushmanta as her husband. As far as Maharaj Dushmanta was concerned, he desired Shakuntala as his wife from the very beginning, as soon as he saw her. So the agreement to unite as husband and wife was natural. To induce Shakuntala to accept the marriage, Maharaj Dushmanta reminded her that as a daughter of a king, she should select her husband in an open assembly. In the history of Aryan civilization, there have been many instances in which famous princesses have selected their husbands in open competitions. For example, it was in such a competition that Sita Devi accepted Lord Ramachandra as her husband, and that Draupadi accepted Arjuna. And there are many other instances. So marriage by agreement or by selecting one's own husband in an open competition is allowed. There are 8 kinds of marriage, of which marriage by agreement is called Gandharva marriage. Generally the parents select the husband or wife for their daughter or son, but Gandharva marriage takes place by personal selection. Still, although marriage by personal selection or by agreement took place in the past, we find no such thing as divorce by disagreement. In other words, I think that means we find no such thing as divorce because of disagreement. I think that's what's... Yeah, because of disagreement. Of course, divorce by disagreement or because of disagreement took place among low-class men, but marriage by agreement was found even in the very highest classes, especially in the royal Kshatriya families. Maharaj Dushmanta's acceptance of Shakuntala as his wife was sanctioned by Vedic culture. How the marriage took place is described in the next verse. Om Ganatam Anandasya Jananjana Shalakaya Chakshuna Molitam Yena Tasma Shri Vidave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swaparantikam. So here we find one of these rare, rare instances where the relationship between man and woman is being discussed in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Right? Yeah, it's a joke. Wrong. No, it's not rare. Just if you, matter of fact, if you, this is in this canto alone, if you just go back to the table of contents, what do we have here? We have, just looking through the chapter titles, started off the marriage of Sukanya and Chaivana Muni. There's a whole chapter there dealing with this subject. Then later on, not much further on, we have the downfall of Sobari Muni. That's a whole other chapter dealing with this. Then you have King Puru Rava, enchanted by Ravasi. There's three. And King Yayati regains his youth, and that whole thing with King Yayati. So that's four. And now this one. And there's probably a bunch of other little ones in there that I kind of don't remember, that are just kind of sprinkled in there. So it's a very prominent subject that keeps coming up in the Srimad Bhagavatam, because obviously it's super important, and something, you know, very important for us to we have to understand something very important, you know, from this, and that's why it's repeatedly coming up in the Bhagavatam. And one thought that immediately comes to my mind is that expression, don't play with fire. You know, why is that? Well, fire, think about it. Fire is something that can be very useful. You know, you can cook with fire, you can heat with fire, but it's simultaneously, it's potentially very dangerous. And that's why that expression is there. Don't play with fire. You can use fire very carefully, but don't play with it. Because if you play with it, you can, you know, cause a disaster. So it's the same thing. Sex life is, you know, this whole thing between man and woman, it's in the same category. It's very, it can be very useful. As we're going to see here in this very story that we're hearing now, Maharaj Dushmanta, he married. He went ahead and married Shakuntala. And the result was an offspring, Bharat, who became the emperor. And it's mentioned that he was a partial expansion of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Not funny, but it's mentioned there. So, you know, it can be very useful, this combination between man and woman, but at the same time, like fire, it's potentially very dangerous. It's something that if it's not done carefully, can cause wreak havoc in the life, material and spiritual lives of the people who are, you know, not being careful. So that's why so many stories are there, you know, to try to help us understand that and really kind of get that to sink into our heads. It's because it's an important foundational understanding that we require in order to progress in devotional service. Okay, so let's look at this today's story and verse and purport. So what's happening here? So this Maharaj, King Dushmanta, he's touring like these kings and emperors tended to do. He's with some soldiers, and he comes upon the ashram of Kanva Muni, and it's describing how he was, you know, he was exhausted and everything like that, and he sees this extremely beautiful girl, and he immediately becomes attracted to her, and he immediately starts chatting her up, you know. Oh, hi, who are you? What are you doing here? And you know, in a more sophisticated way. But basically, you know, he just got attracted. He started talking to her, and she was attracted back, and she talked to him. And before you know it, he was proposing marriage to her, and she was accepting, and that's what happened. You know, and he actually did the marriage ceremony, it's described, because he was the emperor, and he knew them how to do it, and he just went ahead and married her that same day. And that evening, they were husband and wife, so they had relationships, and he impregnated her. And then the next day he went off. He left the next day, you know. So now what's that all about? Well, first of all, we'll have to continue the story a little bit further. Yeah, it's true, he did. But as I mentioned, that offspring, Bart, was it's described he was powerful, like a lion. He used to play with the lions in the forest. He was so powerful. You know, there was no problem for him. And it's mentioned, he's actually a partial expansion of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And so at one point, when he grew up a little bit, Shakuntala took him to the kingdom, you know, where his father was, Maharaj Dushmanta, and said, okay, here we are. Remember me, I'm your wife, and here's your son. And Maharaj Dushmanta, at first, wouldn't acknowledge. He wouldn't acknowledge because he was thinking, well, can't do this. I mean, nobody in, they're unknown to everybody in this whole kingdom. I can't just say, yeah. And he was ashamed. He was embarrassed to acknowledge that, yeah, this is my wife and this is my son, I guess, from, you know, our relationship. So, but then something really far out happened. It was an omen, a voice from the sky. And it said, let's see what, I'll just read it so you can get it. Right from the omen's mouth, so to speak. Oh, Maharaj Dushmanta, oh, a son actually belongs to his father, whereas the mother is only a container, like the skin of a bellows. According to the Vedic injunctions, the father is born as the son. Therefore, maintain your son, your own son, and do not insult Shakuntala. O King Dushmanta, he who discharges semen is the actual father, and his son saves him from the custody of Yamaraj. You are the actual protector of this child. Indeed, Shakuntala is speaking the truth. So after hearing that omen, he decided, okay, everybody, that, by the way, that took place in public. You know, it was like everybody heard it. It wasn't just like him there and Shakuntala and the son. It was in public. So all these people heard it. So it describes in the Purport, Prabhupada says that, you know, he figured, well, everybody knows, and they heard it from the omen, so I might as well own up to it. And he accepted them. But the thing is this, so is a Vedic aphorism, palena parichite. You judge a process by the result. So we shouldn't, upon hearing this, think that, you know, jump to the conclusion that this was irreligious or negative in any way, because look at the result. The result was, I mean, he obviously did it in the right way. He obviously wasn't a bad thing, because, you know, partial incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead took birth as a result of this combination. And he went on to be a great emperor in the history of the world. Actually, I think this is the Bharat. There's three Bharats, from what I can understand. There's Bharat, who's the son of Rishabhdev. There's this Bharat, and then there's another Bharat, who's Bharat Muni, who's a famous playwright or something like that. But I think, you know, this earth planet was known as, is known as now, as Bharat Varsha. And I think this is the Bharat that it's named after, not Bharat Maharaj, who is the son of Lord Rishabhdev. And it's described here a little further on that, in one of the translations, that there was never anybody who could, you know, perform the type of activities he performed, the glorious activities he performed, nor will there ever be one in the future. So he was really, you know, very incredible personality. So once again, you judge a process by the result. It sounds like, superficially, it sounds like, whoa, this is like, you know, not very impressive. I mean, he just met her and he just, you know, all of a sudden they get together. But, you know, here's the result is that some great personality came into, you know, being and, you know, ruled the earth and did so many wonderful things. So, but then the next point that needs to be made is this. Okay, so can we do this? I mean, should we be, you know, we have to be careful in our thing. We read these stories and we think, well, you know, we're just hearing about these people. We got to remember that these aren't ordinary people. You know, I mean, Shakuntala was no ordinary girl in an ashram. Maharaj Dushmanta was no ordinary guy who just happened to be roaming through the woods. These are like super elevated, exalted personalities. And the kind of things that they can do, we can't do. You know, so we have to be very careful to take, you know, get these ideas out of our head to imitate. On that, along those lines, is one really, I think it's a bona fide Prabhupada story that I've heard, that I think Prabhupada told. There was this very famous... And so there's this one guy, he decided, yeah, I'd like to do that. That's the kind of work I'd like to do. So, you know, he went and he said, can I be your apprentice? And the veterinarian said, sure, okay, you could do. Now, being an apprentice is not an easy job. You know, you got to work when you're an apprentice because, you know, they give you all the, you do all the, you know, the labor basically. And the person who's training you, they do, you know, they're instructing you. So this apprentice, he was doing it, you know, he was doing all the work and everything. And, but what he observed was on the first day out that this veterinarian, he went to do this, this horse who's had a problem. The one farmer was complaining, my horse is, you know, having some problem with his breathing and this and that. Or he seems like he's, you know, he's really gasping. Anyway, he's having some problem. So the veterinarian went and he kind of did a diagnosis. He checked, you know, he did an exam and he looked at him and he checked him out and everything. He said, okay, yeah. And he said to this, apprentice, hand me my mallet. So the apprentice opened his bag and handed him the mallet. And the vet, he took the mallet and he went whap. And he whapped that horse right on the throat, you know, where there was a big lump. And all of a sudden that lump disappeared, you know, and the horse just sort of went and he was okay. You know, the horse was okay. So the apprentice, when he saw that, he thought, I could do that. I mean, I could do that. What's the problem? Why do I have to, you know, do so much hard work being this guy's apprentice? I'll open my own practice. So he's, you know, left and he started doing that. He started going, you know, being called to jobs to see animals. And then shortly after that, the local people, they complained to the veterinarian, says, hey, your apprentice is wreaking havoc. You know, he's going around, he's treating different animals, and he's basically injuring them or killing them. You know, what are you doing? First he said, hey, hang on, this guy's not my apprentice. He was with me for one day, and he left. I don't take any responsibility for this. Well, anyway, could you do something about it? I mean, you know, you're the famous veterinarian in this area. Can you approach him and, you know, stop this guy and sort him out, you know? He said, okay, well, let me see what I can do. So he finally, he's going around, and he finally spotted him. He saw him. He said, hey, you, come here. What are you doing? What's going on? I'm getting reports that you're going around and you're injuring animals and killing them. What are you doing? He said, well, I'm just doing what I saw you do. I'm taking, the mallet and I'm whacking him in the throat. And, it's just not, I think I just got get a little bit better at it. Maybe I'm just not whacking him in exactly the right way. I think with a little bit more practice, I'll be able to do it perfectly like you, and I'll be able to cure all the animals. And he said, and the veterinarian said, you fool, you stupid fool. He said, that's what you saw me do is a very special, unorthodox treatment for a very specific case. That horse that you saw me whack in the throat with the mallet had a watermelon stuck in his throat. And I took that mallet and I hit that watermelon, and it shattered the watermelon and it dislodged it from his throat. It enabled him to swallow it. And then, of course, he just, you know, digested it and he was okay. That's a very specific application. It's not general treatment. So in other words, from this we can understand that, you know, you can't imitate. As this, you know, wayward apprentice was doing, he made a mess of things. So in the same way, in our own lives, we can hear these stories. We have to appreciate them in the right perspective. We can't think in any way, shape, or form that we can imitate these personalities, because they're on a totally different level. Just like Prabhupada, you know, the famous examples are there in a purport in the Bhagavad Gita that Prabhupada would always say, you know, people want to imitate Krishna. They want to imitate Krishna by performing the rasa dance, but Prabhupada would say, first, you know, let's see them lift Govardhan Hill, right? Or there's something in relation to Lord Shiva too. You know, they want to be like, you know, Lord Shiva and smoke marijuana, you know, because apparently Lord Shiva smokes ganja, but he said, let's see them drink an ocean of poison, right? Those are the two examples. So, yeah, you before you perform those activities, you know, the Ishvaras, the very powerful persons, you have to be able to be on that level. You can't imitate. So that's there. Now, in the purport, Prabhupada's, I think the main, well, there's a lot of nice points, of course, in the purport. One point that really kind of stuck in my mind as an important point, down here towards the bottom, Prabhupada says, he's talking about the different marriages. So he goes here, so marriage by agreement or by selecting one's own husband in an open competition is allowed, and was allowed then, and I guess still. There are 8 kinds of marriage, of which marriage by agreement is called Gandharva marriage. Generally, the parents select the husband and wife for their daughter and so on. But Gandharva marriage takes place by personal selection. And now he makes his point. Still, although marriage by personal selection or by agreement took place in the past, so it did happen. Prabhupada's acknowledging it did happen. But he says, but this is what didn't happen. What didn't happen is we find no such thing as divorce because of disagreement. You see? Of course, divorce by disagreement took place among low-class men, but it, you know, not otherwise. So the point there is that, you know, in a relationship like that, here specifically talking about the marriage relationship, it's basically there's going to be disagreement, you know, but what didn't happen is there wasn't divorce because of that disagreement. In other words, the people work through it. They work through it. If you're not, and this is holds true not just for this particular relationship, which is certainly does hold true for the marriage relationship. It holds true for any relationship, a relationship among friends, a relationship between authority, subordinate and superior like that. In any relationship, there's going to be disagreement. And what you have to learn how to do is you have to work at it. If you're not prepared to work at a relationship, you're going to have a lot of relationships that don't work, basically, or you're not going to have them. So you have to be prepared to work at a relationship, be it marriage, and which is what people were prepared to do previously, friendship, employment, you know, working master servant kind of thing. You really have to work at it. It does require that. Just like, I mean, it's not just like a service. I mean, is there anybody here who hasn't experienced any difficulties in the course of executing their service? You know, in their whole career in Krishna consciousness? I mean, there's no, you know, anybody here who didn't have any difficulties, who just finds it a breeze all the time? No. Nobody. Everybody has some difficulty. So what do you do when you incur those difficulties? You know, there's an expression, we used to have this expression back in the early days of book distribution, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. You see? So when you get to the difficulty, that's when you got to, you know, tighten your belt, you know, suck it in, and you got to go for it. You got to try harder at the service. You got to, you know, talk to somebody who's doing better at it than you and find out what you're doing, what they're doing right, what you're doing wrong. You got to champ better rounds. You got to eat less, sleep less, whatever. You know, you got to try harder to be successful. And same thing in a relationship. It's like that in our service. Sometimes we don't think about that like in relationships in that terms, but it's true there too. It's true. It's the same thing. You got to try harder. Sometimes we think of relationships something like work. Okay, we understand work. You got to try harder. But in a relationship, well, that's something I'm supposed to enjoy. So if it's not going the way I want it to be going, then I'm out of there. You know, that's not something I should have to work harder at. That's something that I should be just, you know, it's just for me to enjoy. But that's a misconception. You know, it's a misconception. For instance, take the marriage relationship. What is it called in the Vedic? It's called Vivaha Jagya. It's a Jagya. It means it's a sacrifice, just like Sankirtan Jagya. In other words, it's a service. It's something. It's not something you do for your enjoyment. I mean, that might be there. You see, just like when you just let's use the other Sankirtan. You might enjoy Sankirtan, but ultimately it's a Jagya. It's a sacrifice. And so you got to be prepared to go out there. And, you know, whether it's Harinam or book distribution, and come out of your comfort zone and, you know, do what you're supposed to do, whether it feels good or not. You know, whether if you're feeling comfortable because of the, you know, you're warm, nice and cozy and warm, or you're cold, or it's hot, or the people like you, or they don't like you, it's a Jagya, right? Whether you're getting good results, you're not getting good results, you got to do it. Same thing. Babaya Jagya. Just a different type of Jagya. You know, it's a relationship Jagya as opposed to an activity Jagya, you see? But the same idea is there. It's you have to do it. There's a higher principle involved. But like I've been told that in India they have this expression. In India, you don't marry who you love, but you love who you marry. So what's that mean? That means it's duty. You see, there's an element of duty there that has to be understood. You love who you marry. In other words, you're with somebody, and you know, there might be, as it says here, disagreements or whatever, but there's a higher principle involved. See, and that principle is that you got to do it to please Krishna. See, actually, at the root cause of all this problem with relationships, and Satchidananda, I hope he's going to love this because I know he's really into relationships, is atheism. Atheism, and I'll even take it one step further in a second. I'll explain how atheism is the root cause, because what atheism is this, is saying that there is no God in control. There is no God. There's no God who created everything. There's no God in control. It's just things have happened by chance. And therefore, you know, here we are. There's no meaning. There's no purpose to life. You know, there's no purpose to life other than that we're here. You got some time. You got a situation. Make the best of it. Don't be stupid. Make the best of your opportunity to enjoy life in whatever way you can. Right, there's really no such thing as right and wrong in any moral or ethical sense. I mean, maybe something's wrong if other people don't like it and it's going to cause you some problems. But really, there's no absolute sense of morality or no. That's just all sentiment. Just make the best of it. You know, and so people who are atheists who don't believe that there is a God who created everything and that there's a purpose to this creation. That selfish mentality is the underlying psychology. That here I am. I mean, I gotta just I gotta try to enjoy my life. See, so they think everything is for their enjoyment. See, whereas a person who's a theist, he's thinking differently. And it makes sense that that they would behave in the way they do. Okay, but a person who's a theist is thinking, no, there is a God. There's a God who created everything. He's controlling everything. He's created this whole thing for a purpose. And there's a way in which he wants me to behave. You know, there's things I'm supposed to do so that he's pleased. They're concerned with what's going to happen to them after death. Because the atheist believes that when you're dead, that's it. That's the end of everything. Whereas the theist, he believes that, no, when you're dead, that's not the end. Then that's when you depending upon which faith tradition you're buying into, you're either going to get judged and go to heaven or hell, or you're going to take birth again. You know, there's something that goes on after that. So a theistic person is thinking, I got to play my cards right. I got to live my life in such a way that I'm pleasing, these higher authorities, God, his representatives, so that I get a good situation in the future, ultimate, whatever. So that's why a theistic person is more likely to be, try to really keep relationships together, because he's got that motive, that he has that compelling motivation. I want to conduct not just my work, my activities, but my relationships in a way, such a way that God will be pleased. See, dharma, and everything, a theistic person is thinking like that about every different aspect of his life. Let me conduct my relationships in such a way that Krishna will be pleased. Let me perform my activities in such a way that Krishna will be pleased. Let me eat, sleep, etc. Everything in such a way that Krishna will be pleased. So that's a compelling reason. And it relates to that. So therefore, that's an important thing. You know, that we have that. And ultimately, what's at the root? Atheism is just a smokescreen, ultimately, for envy of Krishna. Because if you're an atheist, it means you don't believe in God. So if there is no God, you don't have to serve him. See, that's at the root cause of everything. And Prabhupada repeatedly says that throughout the books, that envy of Krishna is the beginning of material life. See? So one, how would you say it? An example, not an outgrowth of that envy of Krishna, is this philosophy of atheism. It's just a convenient way to get Krishna out of the picture. It's a convenient way to rationalize or make some sort of a presentation by which you don't have to serve Krishna. I don't have to serve Krishna. Why? Because he doesn't exist. There is no God. Simple solution to the problem. You see? So what's the antidote? What's the solution to this problem? Okay, assuming that the root cause of it is atheism, and the root cause of atheism is envy of Krishna, the solution to the problem is devotional service. The solution to the problem is just being what we are, devotional servants. That's our actual constitutional position. We're devotional servants, part and parcel of Krishna, and we're eternally his servants. So actually the solution to the problem is exactly what we're doing here, engaging in devotional service. And how it works is this, once again, bringing it back to relationships, how it works is this, okay? Imagine here, let's take this as being Krishna, this cartel as being Krishna. And I'm going to show you practically, this is not like some sentimental thing, it actually practically, this is like a, I don't know if it's mathematics or physics or what it is, but here's an example. Okay, so this cartel is Krishna, okay? And I wish I could let go of it, but I can't, it'll fall. But imagine this is the center, and you have, and just imagine so many different points coming out in all 360 degrees, going in all directions. And each one of those points represents a living entity. Okay? So there's one point here, there's one point there, there's a point way over there, and there's a point there. And they're at all different distances. Some are real close, some are real far away. Okay? And here's the center. But as they all start, this is kind of like the opposite of the Big Bang. You know, in the Big Bang, you have everything starts and the thing goes out. Okay, but this is like, I don't know what the opposite of a Big Bang would be, the big implosion, okay? You got everything here, everything's out there, okay, and now all of a sudden everything starts coming in towards the center, okay? Now, what could you say about, as all these different points out there in space, close and far, in all different directions, as they all start coming closer to the center, what can you say about their relationship to each other? Yeah, they start coming closer to each other. You see? As all the points come closer to the center, from here, from there, or you name it, they're all coming closer to each other. Automatically. They don't even have to try. Without any separate effort, as they come closer to the center, they come closer to each other. So the idea is, the analogy is, as we come closer to Krishna, you know, as we advance in devotional service, as we surrender and get purified and come closer to Krishna, we all come closer to each other, you know? And that's how it works. And I'll be honest with you, I feel like I'm experiencing that. I've been here 20 years now, and I feel like it happens, it's like on a subliminal level, but I feel like I'm experiencing that, how, you know, just by being here and trying to, you know, practice devotional service for 20 years among other devotees who are doing the same thing, and I feel closer. I feel closer to people. And it's not because of, like, conversations or something like that. Like, you know, like, say, Krishnapad, for instance. I don't think I've exchanged more than two words with Krishnapad. I don't think anybody's... So, no, just kidding. He's very quiet. But, you know, it's not... It's like a lot of nonverbal communication. What happens is you see the devotees performing their service, and you can understand from the activities they're performing, the amount of surrender that represents, and your respect and admiration for the different individuals that you're, you know, living with and associating with every day increases. So that's my way of, you know, that's what I call getting closer. You feel like, yeah, I respect that person, I appreciate that person, and it just keeps getting better and better. Because as you get closer, as we all sincerely try to engage in devotional service, we all get closer to Krishna, and we all get closer to each other automatically. There it is, see? Like that. So, now, is that, does it end there? Well, yeah, it kind of can end there. But this is an important preaching point, too, and I'll explain that. Because here we are, there's an expression. If you build a better mousetrap, the entire world will beat a path to your door to get at it. You know, you don't have to go. If you build that better mousetrap, you don't have to go on the internet and advertise it. Or if word gets out, when word gets out that you've built a better mousetrap, the world will beat a path to your door to get at it. So in the same way, you know, when we keep doing just what we're doing, I really feel it. We just have to keep doing exactly what we're doing here. As we get, you know, more purified and more advanced, then at some point, this place is going to become, you know, word's going to get out. You know, people are going to come here. Like, I was just having this fantasy as I was preparing the class of, like, you know, two people come here in a car, one for the first time and is bringing a friend. And then as they're driving away in the car, the friend says, whoa, was that place, like, awesome or what? You know, and the other person says, yeah, Hare Krishna's, man. They really, you know, this is a nice place. The people are really nice. It's really simple. It's really sweet. Says, yeah, I mean, that was an amazing experience. You know, like that. People are just going to, they're just going to come here and they're going to like it because they're going to feel, is it, once again, nonverbal, they're just going to feel the good vibes. You know, they're going to feel the good vibes. And then things can really happen, spread. Krishna, that could really mean like a really significant spreading of Krishna consciousness here in Los Angeles just by that. Prabhupada's the example. Prabhupada this was 72. He wrote this letter to Sudama, disciple. And in one part of the letter, he goes, when I was alone in your New York, I was thinking, who will listen to me in this horrible, sinful place? But at least I can distribute a few of my books. That is something. Prabhupada said this stuff. He said, but Krishna was all along planning something I could not see. He brought you nice American boys and girls to me one by one, for helping to spread the message of Lord Chaitanya. Now I could see it as a miracle. Otherwise, one old man in your city of New York with barely enough money to get edibles, how could he survive? What to speak of spreading a God consciousness movement for the, you know, salvation of the entire universe. And he repeated, now I could see it as a miracle. But the point is, Prabhupada said, but Krishna was all along planning something I could not see. See, so that's how it really works. That's how the Krishna, that's the real understanding of how the Krishna consciousness movement spreads. Krishna's all along, he's watching. Krishna's watching. It's not, you know, our efforts to go out and distribute a lot of books, that's significant in my understanding, in that we're demonstrating to Krishna where we're at. You see, the numbers aren't really what counts. It's the, it's the, It's the sincerity. It's the surrender. It's the effort. Krishna's observing. And when Krishna's sufficiently pleased, he reciprocates. You see? There's another quote in the fourth canto where it says, the pure devotee is always thinking about how to deliver the fallen conditioned souls. And Krishna, how's it go? And Krishna, by his causeless mercy, enlightens the general populace from within by his causeless mercy. So in other words, it's in the fourth canto. I can't remember exactly where, but the idea being that it's a reciprocation. As the general populace is getting enlightened from within because Krishna is reciprocating with the pure devotee. You see, the nice American, nice young American boys and girls who came one by one to help spread the message of Lord Chaitanya, that was Krishna reciprocating with Prabhupada's sincerity. Prabhupada, Krishna could see how much Prabhupada was surrendering, how much he, was totally sold out to fulfilling, executing the instruction of his spiritual master. And at some point, Krishna just went, look, these people don't deserve to get an opportunity for devotional service, but what can I do? Here's my pure devotee trying so sincerely to do this, and I can't see him disappointed. So, okay, you, get, be inspired. You got to come forward and become devotees like that. And that's how it works. That's my understanding. So in the same way, we just have to keep doing what we're doing. Just, what's the problem? It's boil the milk. And just exactly what we're doing here, it's perfect. And just worshiping the deities and kirtans and sankirtan, exactly what we're doing, and try to do it more and more nicely, and hopefully at some point we'll be blessed to experience what Prabhupada experienced, that Krishna will, who's all along planning something we cannot see, will be pleased, and then he'll bless us, he'll reciprocate by sending not just like one or two, but like lots and lots of people to become interested in Krishna consciousness. Not necessarily move in the temple, but all sorts of far out things could happen. I mean, Krishna consciousness could become popular. More people could come here, but people could start practicing and outside and come, and it could become a very amazing dynamic situation. Anyway, everybody gets the idea. So I'll stop there. Does anybody have any questions or comments? Rabindranath Prabhu. Yeah. Waiting for the mic. Actually, Rabindranath kind of had his hand up first, so I guess we'll go with him.
Yeah, you mentioned how we can't imitate these personalities who had marriages like this, but also Srila Prabhupada mentions in the Bhagavatam about how that there's eight different types of marriages.
Eight kinds of marriages, yeah.
Yeah, and only the Brahma marriage is allowed in the age of Kali. Other marriages like Gandharva marriage and kidnapping the bride is forbidden, like that.
Right, so that confirms the point. We can't imitate. It's actually, there's a Vedic injunction that only, which kind of marriage is allowed?
A Brahma marriage.
A Brahma marriage?
Yeah, only the Brahma marriage is allowed.
Okay.
But not kidnapping the bride or by love or like that. It's not allowed. Gandharva marriage.
So we're not just bound by the injunction as well. Sachidanoi Prabhu.
Thank you, Prabhu. I had a few questions, but I'm just going to make one.
Okay.
There's no time. You were mentioning at one point that you were imagining or picturing people coming, joining. So I just came to my mind that Prabhupada one time had a conversation with someone where he said that in the future, there will be thousands of people coming. So can you please name two or three practical things that we're supposed to be ready to welcome if that happens, thousands coming to this temple? How will you practically accommodate or engage them?
Well, I mean, the first idea that pops to my mind that's practical is that we just have to be prepared to be very nice and friendly, because obviously we don't have facility to, we can't offer them to move into the ashram. We don't have any farm set up to tell them to go live on or anything like that. But, this is America. People have living arrangements, but I think we have to be Brahmins. And when they come, give them good instruction. Welcome them, be friendly, tell them to chant Hare Krishna, tell them to be vegetarians, tell them to offer their food, teach them how to be very simply and quick, teach them how to be devotees in their own situation and encourage them to come and as much as possible and, tell them about our website on the internet and just encourage them. People can be devotees without living in the ashram, and that's, if we're talking about thousands, that's obviously what will have to happen. We don't have any place to send them. We can't have them, we can't move them in here. We're just going to have to be, you know, nice enough to, you know, give them that instruction how to be devotees in their own situation, and hopefully that'll happen in a big way.
So that means we're not really prepared.
Well, we're prepared to do that. That's pretty significant. I mean, you know, it would be wonderful if we had farms set up that we could kind of move people off onto, but we don't. That's far away. But you know, we are prepared to give people nice instruction. We have books. You know, we have a model here, a working model here, and we have the books, and we have devotees who've got, like, you know, hundreds of years, between combined, we have hundreds of years of experience of devotional service here. We have people who've been devotees for, you know, 20, 30, 40, 45 years now. So I think we should be able to give them nice instruction and inspiration how to practice devotional service in their own orbit there, in their own situation. Suhas Prabhu?
Thank you for a wonderful class. I think another point that Prabhupada made yesterday that really answers that question by Satchitananda Prabhu, and that is that Prabhupada said we should make first-class devotees, that we should become first-class. Everyone should endeavor and try to become first-class. And by becoming first-class, everything will come from there. Because if you make a lot of first-class devotees, they'll open up first-class centers all around L.A. If tens of thousands of people come, we can't just have one temple.
There's going to be more temples as guests
throughout the whole county of Los Angeles. But they have to be first-class devotees, first-class men and women. Otherwise, it's a useless endeavor. It'll just collapse.
Yeah, very good point. That means a lot of things, but it means coming to the program. We often come to the program. If you're not coming to the program, you might be thinking that, oh, you know, it's not hurting anybody else. No, you're hurting everybody else. If you don't come to the program, you're hurting everybody else. At least that's the way my mind works. Because I come to the program, I'm thinking, well, I came, you know, and I look around, and if I don't see so-and-so, so-and-so, and so-and-so, it's discouraging. I think, well, why didn't so-and-so here? It's like, and when you see everybody here, it's encouraging. So we're not like in this on our own. This is a family. When you come to the program, you're encouraging everybody else. And when you don't come to the program, you're discouraging everybody else. So that's important. That's just one point off the top of my head. There's so many more that could be made. Okay, maybe we'll just stop there because it's already 8:30. Thank you very much. Gantara Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.
I have two questions. Okay. Can I ask them?
Yeah. One of them is, who was the voice in the sky spoke to Maharaj Dushmanta?
Who is the one?
The voice?
Just an omen. Like an omen. It doesn't say. I've read it.
It's someone now, right? It's got to be someone. It's not just
well,
like a random voice.
In the Bible. It's not here in this book. It might be in some other Quran. Something like that, where this particular pastime is more elaborately described, might be. But I've never heard that. I've never heard any further information about that.
My other question is, okay, you said that Maharaj Bharat was a partial expansion of Krishna.
Yeah.
So my...
I think it's a Shaktive Shavatar.
Okay, Shaktive Shavatar. So that's a different Shaktive Shavatar. Partial expansion.
Yeah, it wasn't like a... a certain translation.
So my question
partial,
is...
Partial, he is referred to as a partial representation of the Supreme Personality of God. No, he was in power. He was in power. Any extraordinarily powerful must be considered a partial representation of the office of the Supreme Personality. Yeah, he was. They acknowledged him, accepted him as somebody who was empowered by.
So my question is, what's the difference between a partial expansion, a plenary expansion, and an expansion of a plenary expansion?
Well, plenary means full, right? So a plenary expansion means
like Balaram.
Balaram plenary, fully is all the power, fully powerful. An expansion of a plenary would be just that. Somebody like that. Maybe they may be plenary, they might not be plenary, but it's an expansion of an expansion. And partial means plenary. It's not full, it's just different.
Wait, what's an expansion of an expansion?
Well, you said what's the difference between a plenary expansion and an expansion of a plenary expansion and a partial? An expansion, plenary is a full. An expansion of a plenary might be full and might not be full, depending upon some specific description, you know. It just needs an expansion of the expansion. Right. And partial is just that. And there's a lot of partials.
A partial shaktivesh?
Well, no, not partial. Yes. Once you're, if you're empowered, you're empowered, you're shaktivesh. But you might not, might be shaktivesh just with knowledge. Like I think the four kumars are considered shaktivesh avatars. They're empowered with transcendental knowledge. Preacher Maharaj was, well, not about preacher Maharaj, but there's others who are empowered with this, that, this quality or that quality. They might not be empowered in every different which way, but they're empowered in some particular way. That makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like somebody might be empowered with strength, you know, Parashuram. Parashuram is empowered with strength.
So he's considered a partial expansion?
Yeah, well, yes. Yeah. Some of these are kind of confused. There's one place where Prabhupada will say they're shaktivations, another place where he might say they're Vishnu.
Yeah.
You know, so it gets confusing. But anyway. But, there's a lot of shaktivations.
When the going gets tough, the tough get going.
Yeah, that was like the saying, which is saying from the early days, you know. Yeah, just that. And, you know, you start encountering some difficulties in the service. That's the time to curl up and take a nap. That's the time to kind of go, you know, or just on any particular day, or just